Welcome to China in Focus. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Our top story: Chinese and Japanese vessels facing off in disputed waters near Taiwan. China canceling 40% of scheduled flights to Japan. Tensions between two of Asia's biggest economies are rising fast. Marine Colonel Grant Newsham joins us to unpack what this means for the region.
Where the Chinese are constantly testing, constantly probing, testing will. See what the Japanese will do to defend themselves, and as importantly, what the Americans will do to step in to help the Japanese. As I mean, a standing headquarters where Japanese and American forces and officers do the necessary patrols, exercises, ready to defend the place, and if necessary, to push back, and if necessary, shoot back if fired upon. We don't have that, amazingly enough. The Japanese seem to be wanting to do it themselves, and it doesn't appear the Americans have actually talked to the Japanese and said, look, let's do this together.
The poor quality of Chinese goods is back in the spotlight after a devastating fire in Hong Kong. Counterfeit goods cost one Chinese businessman millions of dollars in losses. He shares his firsthand experience with us.
These counterfeit goods aren't just made by one company. They're part of a nationwide, systematic problem.
A fresh standoff between Chinese and Japanese vessels in disputed waters not far from Taiwan. Japan says it intercepted two Chinese Coast Guard patrol ships in waters around Senkaku Islands on Tuesday. That's as tensions continue to mount following remarks from Japan's prime minister that Tokyo could intervene militarily if China invades Taiwan. Japan says the Chinese patrol ships sailed toward a Japanese fishing boat and left after a warning from a Japanese Coast Guard vessel. China gave a different account of the confrontation. It said a Japanese fishing vessel had illegally entered the waters of the Senkaku Islands before being expelled. Both China and Japan claim Senkaku Islands as their own. The disputed islands lie around 100 miles east of Taiwan. Confrontation comes as tensions between Asia's two largest economies spill over into trade, culture, and tourism. China is canceling 40% of flights to Japan scheduled for December. That's around 2,000 flights. It's significant as Japan gets more tourists from China than anywhere else in the world. The canceled flights could cost Japan over $1 billion in tourist spending by the end of the year. And it's not just tourism. Last Friday in Shanghai, a Japanese singer was forced to stop mid-performance. The lights and sound were cut off in the middle of a song. China also canceled a dozen concerts by Japanese musicians last month. A new poll shows Japanese people are divided over whether Tokyo should intervene militarily if China invades Taiwan. 48% support the move and 44% are against it. But over 60% support the Japanese prime minister's plan to increase the defense budget. The prime minister's approval rating is holding steady at 75%, up 1% from last month. Tensions in the East China Sea as Chinese and Japanese ships face off around the Senkaku Islands. What does this latest spat signal in the region, and could this turn kinetic? Joining us to unpack the latest is retired Marine Colonel Grant Newsham. He's a senior fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and author of When China Attacks. Grant Newsham, thank you so much for joining us. Great to have you back on the show.
No, always good to be here.
Now, amid the latest China-Japan spat, China and Japan's coast guards are giving different accounts of the latest confrontation around the Senkaku Islands. These are geopolitically strategic islands. First, how are you reading this latest escalation, if you will?
Well, it's all part of China's long-term objective, and that is ultimately to dominate the Japanese, to take Japanese territory, and put the Japanese in their place and humiliate them in the process. What's been going on around the Senkakus has been going on for well over a decade now, but the Chinese are around the islands every day. They're more aggressive in more places more often than they've ever been. And this latest episode, if you look at what they're saying about it, it is very direct. It's saying, this is our place. We're going to keep Japanese fishing boats out of here. What's there to discuss? They're turning up the heat on all fronts, and this is just one more example around the Senkakus.
Now, to your point, China has been sending an increasing number of ships towards these islands. Last year marked a record high for the third straight year in a row. Now, given that the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, the two nations are to defend each other if one comes under attack, it's not a strategic ambiguity that Taiwan has. Given all of that, what is Beijing probing here? Could it turn kinetic?
Well, there's no reason it couldn't. And one does get the impression that the Chinese just might be out for blood. They just might not mind if somebody gets hurt, if there's some shooting. And you look at the activities they have done, say, interfering with American, Australian, Canadian, and even Japanese aircraft and ships, particularly aircraft, over the South China Sea, over the East China Sea, international waters. It's a miracle nobody's been hurt. I mean, you drop flares right in front of a, say, of an Australian patrol plane, or you come within 5 feet of a Japanese aircraft. Say this is pretty dicey. And I think the Chinese wouldn't mind somebody getting hurt, somebody getting killed. And then they will say, look, this is our territory. You're in here. We've been telling you not to. And they'll put the onus on the victim, as they always do. It's the classic behavior of a bully. In this case, it is a very aggressive totalitarian China that wants other people's territory. And as part of that, they want to dominate people, control them. And that's their MO. It's really nothing surprising, but it is taking place in the context of this concocted fury that the Chinese have after Japanese Prime Minister Takaichi said in the Diet, the very matter-of-fact statement, yeah, Taiwan's important to us. If China attacks it, we might have to do something. And that is unobjectionable. China, they're just always on the lookout for an excuse, not that they really need one, but they've used this and they've been playing it to the max.
Now, on the point of Takaichi's comments, Craig Singleton, he's the senior director of the China program at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He actually just wrote an op-ed for the New York Times, and part of it says, quote, this is a pivotal moment for regional stability. Japan should hold firm and the United States should stand with it. If either backs down, Beijing will treat it as proof that pressure pays. What are your thoughts on that and how this could play out in the region?
Yeah, well, we've been undergoing a pivotal moment for about the last decade, at least. This is one example, though, where the Chinese are constantly testing, constantly probing, testing will to see what the Japanese will do to defend themselves, and as importantly, what the Americans will do to step in to help the Japanese. And this has been a longstanding issue, not just an issue of failure, I would say, is that the Americans and the Japanese still do not have a joint defense of Japan's southern islands, which is where the Senkakus are. And by joint defense, I don't mean the occasional scripted exercise. I mean a standing headquarters where Japanese and American forces and officers do the necessary patrols, exercises, ready to defend the place, and if necessary, to push back, and if necessary, shoot back if fired upon. We don't have that, amazingly enough. The Japanese seem to be wanting to do it themselves, and it doesn't appear the Americans have actually talked to the Japanese and said, look, let's do this together. There's actually firing ranges that the Americans are entitled to use by treaty down around the Senkaku Islands. You send American aircraft and ships down there and do it with the Japanese Air Force, the Japanese Navy, and use these places. And that is going to send a message, a pretty direct one, to the Chinese that you're not going to be pushed around. But that's what the Chinese are doing. They are testing and probing. And say this has been going on for a long time. And you know, the idea that it's somehow new, that's not quite right. But nonetheless, it is significant. And you just have to drop your guard once in a way that the Chinese recognize that you're going to be in big trouble. And I think they haven't been all that impressed with what the Americans and the Japanese have done to push back against them in this region.
Now, Taiwan is just 160 kilometers southwest of the Senkaku Islands. Given that, what do these Chinese incursions near these islands mean for Taiwan and that possible Chinese invasion?
Well, if you want to attack Taiwan, you have to cover your left flank, look up to the north. And that's where the Japanese islands are. It's where the Japanese military is. The U.S. forces can operate out of there as well. So taking Senkaku Islands would really cover your flank, if you're attacking Taiwan. But also, it is a political, psychological move as well, an attempt of domination, control. And that is as much the meaning as anything else. And the Chinese are trying to, they said, make the Japanese back down, pull out of their own territory. And it, you just keep going, you push and push and push. So there's a political and psychological reason as much as a very sound military operational reason as well.
An important point. Grant Newsham, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, glad to be here. Always appreciate it.
Hong Kong's leader vowing reforms and establishing an independent investigation committee after the Wong Fuk Court fire killed at least 156 people. Around 30 people are still missing. Authorities have arrested suspects in manslaughter and graft probes as investigations into the deadly blaze continue. And citizens' call for transparency are getting louder.
In the aftermath of the Wong Fuk Court fire in Hong Kong, City Chief Executive John Lee on Tuesday announced plans to form an independent committee to review the tragedy.
I call for thorough investigation and serious reform.
Police have arrested 15 people for suspected manslaughter, while 12 people have been detained in a graft probe. Authorities have pointed to renovation work which used substandard plastic mesh and insulating foam. It's thought those items fueled the blaze that spread across seven high-rise towers. Amid rising public anger, advocacy groups are demanding greater transparency and accountability, as Beijing and Hong Kong warn that attempts to politicize the disaster will be severely punished. Asked about the detention of a student from one of the groups and two others whom media reported are being investigated for possible sedition, Lee said,
"I will not tolerate any crimes, particular crimes that exploit the tragedy that we're facing now."
He did not comment on the specific cases. Thousands have gathered to honour the victims, who included at least 9 Indonesian domestic helpers and one from the Philippines. Vigils are also planned this week in Tokyo, Taipei and London.
The fire at Hong Kong's Wong Fuk Court has left at least 156 people dead. At first, the Hong Kong government said the protective netting used at the building's renovation site was flame retardant. But on Monday, officials abruptly reversed course, admitting that samples taken from the site all failed to meet flame retardant standards. These nets were supplied by local contractors, but citizens are questioning whether they were manufactured in mainland China. They want the truth, but so far the government hasn't said a word. We know that the company doing the renovation was using nets made by two manufacturers based in Shandong Province, China, on some other Hong Kong projects. The Chinese language edition of NTD interviewed a businessman from China who has first-hand experience with fake building materials from that same province. He says it's not just one or two companies making counterfeit goods. Chinese authorities encourage the practice, and it's a nationwide systematic problem. Watch.
I believe this fire is the outcome of deep-rooted systemic corruption. Back in 2016, my company bought a large batch of counterfeit building materials. The packaging looked flawless. They were PE pipes. They belonged to the same category of products as the protective nets involved in the fire. After using the pipes on a project, I noticed problems. I sent them to the National Testing Center, and the tests confirmed they failed to meet the standards. The materials I bought were made in Linyi City. The deputy director of the city's Quality Supervision Bureau, a man surnamed Lee, told me, "Mr. Hu, we've already investigated, and the other party is definitely producing counterfeits." He explained that local companies in Shandong Province can't compete with businesses in Jiangsu and Zhejiang provinces because they got a later start. He said, "Counterfeiting isn't limited to just one company. Many are doing it. Our local government depends on these companies for significant tax revenue each year. Both national and local tax authorities have annual targets to meet." He told me, "If we were to shut down all of these companies, the local economy and city development would grind to a halt. These counterfeit goods aren't just made by one company. They're part of a nationwide, systematic problem."
Counterfeit products ruined several major projects for Hu Lizhen, resulting in serious financial losses. He had to pay huge compensation, while the company that sold him the counterfeit goods got away scot-free, protected by local authorities. Hu Lizhen left China for the United States in 2018. While in the U.S., he continued his investigation, sending people to parts of Shandong and Hubei provinces. The results were alarming. In those regions, there are very few companies that do not engage in counterfeiting. The prevailing model seems to be, if you don't cheat, you can't survive. Coming up, FBI Director Kash Patel tells the Epoch Times that fentanyl traffickers are struggling as critical precursors from China dry up. But will the Chinese regime honor its side of the fentanyl deal with America? More on that after the break here on China in Focus. Welcome back to China in Focus. I'm Tiffany Meyer. Drug traffickers in Mexico, Colombia, and Venezuela are scrambling after China says it stopped exporting fentanyl precursor chemicals. That's according to FBI Director Kash Patel, who tells our sister media, the Epoch Times, that the threat of tariffs is keeping the Chinese regime in check. NTD's Washington correspondent Jack Bradley has the details.
When we surveil and monitor and investigate these folks, we see that they are complaining about not having the necessary ingredients and mechanics to make fentanyl. That is an immediate impact that they haven't complained about in years.
FBI Director Kash Patel says drug traffickers in South America are struggling to find the chemicals used to make fentanyl after the supply from China has run dry. Last month, China issued export restrictions on 13 fentanyl precursor chemicals as part of the recent U.S.-China trade deal. Patel says that this leaves cartels with no other alternatives to produce the deadly opioid.
And that pipeline being shut off is forcing drug traffickers to scramble, which we're seeing, for alternatives. And here's the good news. They know and we know there aren't any. That's why we came up with this list.
As part of the U.S.-China trade deal, President Trump lowered the fentanyl tariff on China from 20 to 10%. And Patel says that this gives the U.S. tariff leverage over China so that they can uphold their end of the deal.
The Chinese Communist Party has not lived up to its promises, whether written or verbal. How can you be so sure that this agreement will be honored by the other side?
Because the Chinese government wants additional tariff relief and that tariff relief to maintain, they are going to have to come to the table and continuously show the results with us. And if there isn't, or they violate that agreement on this particular issue, they know the consequences from the president are going to be severe in terms of tariffs and other matters.
In another development, European companies are increasingly moving their sourcing out of China due to China's export controls. That's according to a new survey by the European Union Chamber of Commerce in China released on Monday. The group's president says in a statement, China's export controls have increased the uncertainty felt by European businesses operating in the country, with companies facing risks of production slowdowns or even stoppages. Out of over 130 companies, more than a third say they plan to work with suppliers outside of China, while most say they're not sure how to respond to China's export controls. In October, China expanded export restrictions on rare earths, batteries, and other equipment. Those export restrictions were placed on pause for 1 year as part of that trade deal between the U.S. and China. And that doesn't just apply to the U.S. markets, but expands into the European Union. Reporting from Washington, D.C., Jack Bradley, NTD News.
That's all for today's China in Focus. I'm Tiffany Meyer. If you have any feedback on the show or have something you'd like to see us cover, send us an email at chinainfocus@ntd.com. We'd love to hear from you. For on-the-clock original news coverage, visit us at ntd.com or download our NTD app. Thanks for watching. See you tomorrow.